Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, at Broadway Curtain, and on Instagram, at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
A person's passion for musical theater can be divided into one of three categories. Fan, obsessed, or Stephen Cole.
That's right. Stephen has not only written the book and lyrics for such musicals as After the Fair, The Night of the Hunter, The Road to Qatar, and most recently, Merman's Apprentice, he is also one of the world's foremost experts on the history of the American musical. Now, if you don't believe us, just go to the Facebook page Forgotten Musical and see Stephen's brilliance firsthand.
So without further ado, here to talk about all things musical theater is librettist, lyricist, historian, musical theater superfan, Stephen Cole.
Well, hello. Hello, hello. I didn't get nominated today for any of those things.
I know.
Absolutely.
Just because
upset.
I don't have a Broadway show on now. I mean, what do they think it is?
Technicalities.
Yet.
I have to say, every musical theater aficionado must be jealous of us because we are conducting this interview under a huge poster of Grind.
Yes, right. Friends, Grind.
And there is a beautiful... Is that an oil portrait of Ethel Merman?
That is an oil painting of Ethel Merman. Absolutely.
A young Ethel Merman.
1938, yeah. Also found in an antique store in Nyack.
You're killing me.
I always thought when I saw this, and they didn't know what it was, I said, oh, this must have been in Helen Hayes' house.
Right.
I don't know why, because it was Nyack. And she lived there. And Rosie O'Donnell bought the house and threw it out. I don't know.
Yeah, totally.
But
like,
it's a gorgeous portrait of her. Yeah. And it's by a portrait artist who did celebrity portraits in the 1930s. Actually, more society people.
Yeah. Oh.
A guy named Trefilis. I've done my research. But I have to go on Antiques Roadshow and they'll tell me, restore that damn thing because it's a mess.
Now, how did your relationship with Ethel Merman develop?
Well, oh my God, that's a long story. But I've always been a huge fan of Ethel Merman. So when I was an actor when I started out, and I wrote a show when I was 15, which I got on at 16, mm-hmm. but all that's beyond. And my acting career ended sort of by my own hand at 21 because I stopped looking 12.
Yeah.
And that's when
you retired from acting at 21.
I heavily veiled.
No longer a juvenile lead.
I was not 12 years old anymore. And I didn't know quite what to do, whether to go back to writing or... So I was going to produce. Why not? And it was
so ambitious.
The early days, so easy. And so I decided I wanted to produce Ethel Merman's symphony concert on cable TV. It was the early days of cable. And I had friends who were in TV business. We did a budget. We did promotion. I called up her manager after a concert, and I said, hey, I want to do Ethel Merman on TV. And he said, sure, she's going to be playing Carnegie Hall next year. Why don't you start peddling that? We got Kraft Cheese to sponsor it. It was going to be a Kraft music hall on CBS cable. And 2 months before the concert, CBS cable went under. No more. They're doing the concert at Carnegie Hall. I go to see it with my friend, now her manager, Bob Gardner. And he takes me backstage and she says, I'm coming to your house. Because I had all this video of her and she wanted to see it. 2 days later, she was here in this very living room, right here, sitting, and we watched videos of her from 1930 shorts from the 60s with her son, with Anna Sosenko, who was a producer of her concert. And she started coming over frequently and bringing her friends.
I'm picking my jaw up off the floor right now.
It was really, I was told, don't act like a fan. So I didn't. I was just her friend.
Yeah.
And I was this kid of 20.
I can't believe the tenacity you had.
And it was amazing. It was amazing to open the door and there was Ethel Merman, to look out the window and she was coming up the stairs.
Incredible.
You know, but so we started to get really friendly. She would bring all her friends over to watch these videos. She brought Benet Venuda, her best friend. She brought Maria Karnilova, who was thrilling to meet. And she and Karnilova would talk about Gypsy sitting on my couch, you know, talking about, oh, Ethel, I would cry every night you did Rose's Turn. I go, oh, my God, oh, my God. And we would watch stuff, and she would sit cross-legged on the floor and talk.
Just old clips of her performing.
Oh, major stuff from the 60s. She would say, you see me over there? That's 1964. That dress, I wasn't wearing a bra. Today, if I didn't wear a bra, they'd hit the floor. But now, that was Ethel. She was so funny.
This was all before YouTube. So how did you amass all this stuff?
It was a thing called VHS.
VHS.
We had VHS tapes and film, actual film. And actually, when she passed away, she had left me some of the kinescopes, which were the films from her TV shows from the 50s. And a couple of things. One of them, Anything Goes, with Frank Sinatra and Burt Lahr, I was able to lease to a company. It's out on DVD.
Oh, wow. Fabulous.
Which is really exciting. And she would have loved that. But she loved watching her stuff and commenting and saying, at one point she's watching an old short from 1930 she made in Astoria, Queens, and she said, oh my God, my voice is so tinny, I sound like Ann Miller. And we would say, no, Ethel, it was the recording. She said, no, that was how I sounded.
Oh my
God. Oh, how fun.
She was very funny, and she became, which is why Merman's Apprentice, the show going way fast forward now,
good,
exists, is because I knew the real Ethel. She was just a regular New York dame who walked the streets of New York and, you know, couldn't get a cab and we'd have to put her on a bus and things. She was a great, she was really fun and vulnerable nice. And she'd call me up. I remember answering the phone. She said, oh, I'm going to be on the Tonys and the Oscars. And I go, of course you are. You're Ethel Merman. But she was like, she was 12.
Yeah.
It was still exciting.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was the great part. So that's how I knew her.
Wow. You know, I can understand why she'd really care to see herself perform. You nowadays, I feel like we take for granted that everything's recorded.
Yeah.
But, you know, in her day, she didn't get to see herself very often.
No, exactly.
And I
there
love
would be live TV shows that literally they would send the kinescopes that would be put away in a closet for years, and she'd never thought about it again.
That's incredible.
And it was really fun to do and to see the people in the show. She would watching movies, as I said, from 1930, and she would say, oh, yeah, he went out with Dorothy Hammerstein before she met Oscar. Like, what?
You knew
that.
Wow.
That kind of stuff.
What began your sort of knowledge of Merman? Like, what did anything trigger it when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I had records. Yeah. Remember records?
Oh, I still have them. Oh, yeah.
Real records. I had the records. I had Annie Get Your Gun from Lincoln Center. It knocked me out. I didn't know. All right, I belonged to, in those days, you belonged to record clubs. I was a little kid, belonged to the RCA Record Club, which meant you could not get Columbia records. So I had no idea there was such a thing as the original cast album of Gypsy, because I had the movie.
Oh my God.
Roz Russell.
And I had Roz Russell, who was dubbed by Lisa Kirk.
Of course.
And one day I listened to a radio show just like this, and I heard Ethel singing Rose's Turn instead of Lisa Kirk or Roz Russell. And I was just knocked out of my – I just couldn't believe it. And so I became that kind of fan for a while. And I went to see – I got to see Hello, Dolly on Broadway.
Because you grew up in Brooklyn,
I grew up in Brooklyn, so I'm lucky my mother took me to shows.
And your first one was?
Hello, Dolly. With Betty Grable.
With Betty Grable as
Dolly. Then, and Merman was the first time I went back to a show, you know, where I would see somebody else in it, because I just kind of had this feeling, this isn't going to happen again.
Yeah. Mm.
And I was right.
Yeah.
Now, besides Hello, Dolly, what else did you see growing up?
Oh, Mame. Mame was the second show, and that killed me. That was the best, with Janice Page.
Yeah.
Lansbury was gone. I got to tell Janice Page, you were my Mame. I was so excited to meet her. And it was... That was the first time I sat in the orchestra at the Winter Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was much better than the third balcony of the St. James. And it knocked me out, that show. Just Mame killed me. Oh, but I was lucky. I was in that era. And the 70s came, and there was Company, and there was Follies, and there was a little Night Music, and there was Pacific Overtures.
Yeah.
And those shows just, I knew I was seeing incredible shows then. And cheap. $2.
and did you always know, because you were producer, young age, yes, actor, yes, young age, yes, book writer, writer. Did you always know that you were going to be in the arts in some way?
Yeah, I was that kid who wanted to be a performer. Yeah. You know, didn't get enough love. The whole baloney. So I performed early, and I was in summer stock at 14.
Yeah,
and it was me and Chuck Bush.
I love that. So you wrote, because I read somewhere that you wrote one of your first songs.
I wrote one of my first songs because Chuck and his friend Andy Halliday, who was Andy Cohen then, Andy still works with Charles and his shows, and they had written the book of a show, and they had no score. And they came over to me and said, maybe you want to write songs. And I just went off in the corner and wrote my first song.
That's incredible.
And I thought, well, if they can do it, I can write a show.
Yeah,
and I
did. That's right, Steven. That's exactly right.
What the hell? I can write a show, too.
Now, whereabouts in Brooklyn did you grow up?
Where?
Yeah.
Way out in Canarsie. The last stop on the L.
Randy Graff territory.
Yeah, that's where she's from.
The last stop on the L train. It used to be called the LL train. Yeah, it was stood for hell. Not a good line. An hour. But wow, it was close enough to keep coming in and seeing shows. And that was the best.
Now, you named all the big ones that you saw. What about some of the forgotten ones?
I think the first flop I saw on Broadway
The word flop. That's good to know.
It was a flop. Lovely Ladies, Kind Gentlemen. Which I thought was as good as any other show I saw.
I don't know. You guys,
you
I'm
don't know
such,
Lovely
I,
Ladies.
I'm
kind
ashamed.
Gentlemen.
I know. Oh, Stephen's shaming me right now.
Yes, you do. Because Jim Brochu, who was one of our guests,
yes,
showed us some of the YouTube clips from it.
Oh, that's right. That's what
it's a musical version of the house, of the Tea House of the August Moon. And it starred David Burns.
Because he was friends with
He knew David Burns, exactly.
That's right.
Ron
and
Hussman?
David Burns was brilliant. Yeah. Ron Hussman was in it, and Ray McRamsey.
Who did the music?
It was Stan Freeman and Frank Underwood. And Stan Freeman had written I Had a Ball. He's had two big...
And to be clear, Frank Underwood, the lyricist composer, not Frank Underwood from House of Cards.
Correct. Thank you.
Just so we're clear.
I know every time I've watched that, you didn't write Lovely Ladies, Kind Gentlemen.
I would love if he did.
I don't know where Frank Underwood is now, but there was a time that he was playing in a piano bar in Greenwich Village, and he would play songs from the show. And I'd go, oh my God, I remember that.
So you can go to Maurice Crisis.
Go to Maurice
and
Crisis.
Gonna,
yeah.
You know Lovely Ladies, Kind Gentlemen.
And I knew Stan Freeman a little bit later on, so it was kind of nice, but it was a good show. It was one of the first controversial shows on Broadway where they had Asian characters not played by Asian actors, and so this was 1970-ish, because Merman was across the street in Dolly, and it was at the Majestic.
Oh yeah,
and but that was one of the first flops. I loved going to things like that. You know, I did not get to see Ari. I always regretted that because it had the concentration camp ballet in it, and I missed it.
That's a regret in life.
I missed Ari, but I saw a lot of others. I also missed Jimmy. I wanted to see Jimmy,
which
was at the Winter Garden, and I didn't get to see that. And my biggest regret that my mother made me miss was I Do, which was not a flop, of course, and because she would not go see that show because it only had two actors in it.
And it wasn't worth
Robert
Preston and Mary Martin.
So we saw Golden Rainbow with Stephen Eady. Which was great.
Yeah,
I loved it. That was the thing. When you're 12, you love everything. It was great. It was.
And your parents were supportive of this?
Going to shows, sure. Absolutely. Were they supportive of me as a performer? You know, they didn't think that was a good idea. They wanted me to make money.
Sure.
And that wasn't going to happen, really. I mean, I did summer stock for 3 years in a row as an apprentice.
Yeah.
You know what you make as an apprentice.
Of course.
Yeah. Nothing.
No. What did your folks do for a living?
My father was worked as a salesman in men's hats.
Oh,
and my mother was a housewife, but she also was a bookkeeper. Just average, normal people who, in those days, average, normal people lived in New York, all went to the theater.
Yeah.
Because it was affordable.
Because you could. Yeah.
Because you could. I remember them sitting around looking in the newspaper going, oh, we'll see Cabaret. We'll see we went to Fiddler. We did all. I wasn't allowed to see Cabaret till later. That was a pretty dirty show.
I was kidding. Because it was.
That was
it was
a little
racy.
Show. That was naughty. They came home just laughing about the two ladies' number. That was naughty.
But that's great. I mean, to see so many things that were affordable.
oh,
at
yeah,
that
there
time.
Was that.
When it was affordable.
And then I had all the records, which, you know, just made me imagine the shows. And so...
And isn't today happy 60th
yes,
to
yes,
most happy
60
fellas?
Years.
60
That's
years ago.
Right.
Gosh, happy 60 most
what
happy
a
fella.
Show that is.
Did you see that at Encores?
Oh,
they just,
yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
It was gorgeous. It was really gorgeous.
That was a beautiful production.
I did. You know what I did not see? And thoughts on this? The two piano version.
I did.
I didn't see it.
I saw it. It was fine. It was two pianos.
I just listened to it a week ago.
The orchestra is very important to that show.
Yeah.
And I did. It was an okay cast, but the Encores was primo.
Lush, and you heard
and,
yeah.
And Laura Benanti deserved a Tony for that. She was that good.
Boy,
she was
yeah.
so very special in that. So I'm glad she's in. She loves me because
yeah.
I love
yeah, yeah, absolutely. And she's wonderful in that as yep. well. She can do no wrong in my book.
Yep.
Now, you did a lot of background acting in films?
Oh, yeah.
Or
that
extra?
Was during
I mean,
that whole period.
Background artist, I think is
yes,
what I'm
oh, extras we called them.
Yes, sir.
Background American.
But, of course,
to be
my most my most famous one, you know, which I have photos now because I have snapshots of from All That Jazz. I'm in the opening number of All That Jazz.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was the most fun I had, I think, because it's such a brilliant movie, and we had to learn Bob Fosse's audition, period. So we did the tap, we did the ballet, and I was at the Palace Theater for a week shooting with all these other people. We were all the rejects, and then they brought in the real dancers. And but you've seen that number. It's spectacular. It's you know.
Took a week to film?
Yeah, our part of it. We were there for a week. And it was great. I thought I never met Bob Fosse, but now I've seen this little documentary on YouTube, and I see him sitting up on a ladder, and there I am, very close to him dancing, which made me laugh. So
incredible.
We can add dancing
and
to the
when,
you,
yeah. when you're a background artist, okay, here's the rule of what it was then, and I was in maybe 50 movies. You don't want to be seen because you're there to make money. That's all. And I was hiding in the back on the stage at the Palace. You go, no, because you want to come back the next day. And they'll ask, were you seen on camera? And you go, no. Okay, come back the next day.
Oh,
so
right,
that's
you're
what it was about.
Face.
I learned that from the old extras. You
want to
make that SAG
so
money, and that's what I was doing. And it was just all about that. So, but that one, you know, I do get seen. I think if you go to YouTube, it's 3 minutes and 59 seconds in. There I am. I go on and I freeze it constantly. It's really
amazing.
It's
oh, my God. Sometimes
thing.
It's just my background.
I have hair. It's really great.
Oh, my God. You're killing me.
What else did you do besides All That Jazz?
Oh,
are there
gosh.
Others?
Raging Bull, Superman.
Oh, my God.
What is Going in Style? No one remembers that.
George
that,
Burns?
George Burns, yes, very
See?
Good.
See?
My butt is walking down the street. People laugh. But it's that kind of thing. If your butt is seen, it's okay, but not your face.
Come back the next day.
You can come back again. There were movies that I remember the experience, and I don't know the movie. There was one that we went to the Concord Hotel in the Catskills in the winter and did
oh, wow.
an indoor... We were at the indoor pool also for a week doing a luau. They were roasting a pig over the pool. It was a singles weekend. I have no idea what movie
what
this
movie
is. Somebody found it for me recently, and it was still a movie. I can't remember the name.
It was Gandhi,
TV
actually.
Movies.
It was Gandhi.
I know there was one where I was a student in a classroom, and it was Penny Marshall and Rob what's his face?
Reiner?
Her husband.
Right? Oh, Rob Reiner, yeah.
They were married then.
They were married,
teachers at a school. And I remember, because if you looked, the people would call me up and say, you still look 12? Yeah, I still look 12. That's right.
Well, you really kept the 12 thing going.
Oh, yeah, kept that going. Face. Kept it going, the baby face. And that's why I said it, 21, over.
Yeah.
It was
21?
Done.
I'm a
done.
Producer
it
now.
Then he becomes producer.
It's because I was doing things on stage, like To Kill a Mockingbird, playing Dill, who's 6 in the show.
Right.
And then I remember, I did it. An Indiana rep, and then I came back to New York, and they were going to do it in another theater, and they said, oh, no, you're too old. I went, oh, it's over.
My career is done.
Done. Peaked at 12. Now, this might be hard, but I'm going to ask you, favorite Cole Porter song?
God, that is hard, really hard. But I've been thinking about one of my favorite songs, I Concentrate on You, because the lyric is so... specially constructed, the way the rhymes fall in different sections, and it's so unique. And I think when I knew that even then, that it was unique to connect how things rhyme, and it wasn't a normal song. And it, yet it's very simple, 32 bars and gorgeous. And so I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but I've been thinking about that song a lot.
I think it's great.
And it's just great, yeah.
Did you grow up on movie musicals as well?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I saw first. I didn't know there were stage shows until I went to Hello, Dolly. Hello, Dolly was a fluke. My mother and I would come and see shows, movies, never shows, at Radio City and things like that. And there was nothing to see one day. And we're passing underneath this theater. And I said, why can't we see that movie? And it was Hello, Dolly. And she said, that's not a movie. And yeah. She got tickets. And I went,
that's amazing.
I looked down from the third balcony and I saw live people. And I saw, and they did an encore to the title song. And I never knew there was such a thing. But movie musicals were, and Mary Poppins and Sound of Music. Yeah. And those were the records I had first, too. I always had the soundtracks because I saw the movies. My Fair Lady, I saw those in reserved seats. Star, talk about Star, Sweet Charity, Paint Your Wagon, yeah. All the theaters Paint that used wagon. To be on Broadway.
Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. They're all gone. You know, the Lowy State and the Rivoli and all those were reserved seat movies. You would get your seats and they had intermissions and they had souvenir books. I still have them all. Souvenir books. And
yeah, I think a younger generation doesn't know about that era where you would go, movies would be playing all day long. You kind of go in and hang out and come, you know. Yeah.
But reserved seats was
that's amazing. Fancy.
I took a girl on our first date to see Paint Your Wagon. She never saw me again.
Her loss.
Well, it's not your fault. I mean, it was Paint Your Wagon, the movie.
You see, no, it wasn't because of that. It was because they were selling the souvenir book and I didn't have enough money and I had to borrow money from her for the souvenir book. And so she didn't think that was a good date. We were 13.
I think you're classic.
Oh, I love
but
13.
I had
you took
it.
Her to a
paint
wagon.
Oh, where else
me.
To go besides Paint Your Wagon? I love it. Now, I have to ask you, I love obscure films.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And this was one when I was doing research on you I had never heard of before. Electric Grandmother?
Yeah.
This is not, I never knew this, so
well,
I feel like I'm out of the loop.
It was a TV film. And that's what, and one of my shows is based on that.
Yeah.
One of my early shows. It was a story by, what's his name?
Ray Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury, yeah. Right. But I had seen the TV film starring Maureen Stapleton as literally an electric grandmother. She's a robot grandmother. And it was so
literally
moving.
An electric?
Yes. Yeah. She's
grandmother,
yes, it's about
you guys?
These two little kids who lose their mother, and the father takes them to a factory to get a replacement. And they figure, I like those eyes. I like those arms. And they put together a robot grandmother, the perfect grandmother. And it's Maureen Stapleton. Wouldn't it be cuddly, cozy? Yeah. And she is a robot. And she comes to live with them. And the little girl, there's a boy and a girl. The boy loves her madly. And the little girl refuses to love her. And we find out the whole crux of the story is that since she lost her mother, she thinks she'll lose her too. And the end, the grandmother says to her, no, I can't die. I'm a machine. And that's what it is. So it's real Ray Bradbury. And I had to write a song for that moment. So I got together with, that was my collaborator, Matthew Ward, who I also wrote
After the Fair
with. And we wrote the 11 o'clock song. It was called I'm Forever. I won't leave you. I'm forever. And it was all about how I'm a machine. I mean, some of the most soaring notes are on that. And we didn't get the rights to that from Ray Bradbury. Oh. It was a mistake was made. Agents said we had stuff, and I spoke to him on the phone, and he said, "Oh no, I'm writing my own musical."
Well, because he did have a foray into musicals for a while. I feel
yeah, but he didn't do that one. And then little by little, and I would talk to him again years later, and he'd say, "Oh, you can have the rights now." And then he'd call me up and say, "Oh no, we sold the movie rights again." So it just went away. But as it went away, Matt and I were writing After the Fair. Mm-hmm. Which was a public domain story, Thomas Hardy, and we purloined many of the best tunes,
yeah.
And that was one of them. I'm Forever became Your Words Are Music.
Oh,
that was that melody. I went, I'm not losing that melody, so I did it.
Wow.
So that was the Electric Grandmother. It's a lovely film. It might be out on DVD.
I don't know. I'm dying to see it.
And
now.
it was also a Twilight Zone before that.
Oh, really?
Because it is.
Well, it is wacky. It makes sense. And it actually lends itself well. It's right. It was musical.
It was. There's some great stuff that's still there that we didn't reuse. Mm-hmm. And we did this unbelievably great demo with Beth Fowler as the Electric Grandmother.
Nice.
And she was heaven. And so there's still stuff. I've read it recently. And once again, I went, oh, I could rewrite this.
Yeah.
I'm better now.
Yeah, yeah.
The lyrics are still good.
Wow. How was the writing process with Klabe on that?
He was not the easiest guy to write with, oddly enough.
Really?
He was very exacting. I dragged him out of retirement, which I didn't really know. He's like 20 years older, but we would sometimes have huge fights, which he told me. He said, I used to have huge fights with Kenward on the Grasshopper. And I go, well, we'll never fight, but we did.
Kenward Elmsley, yeah.
Yeah, Kenward Elmsley. And we did, and I would leave there sometimes. I always rode my bike back and forth. He's on the Upper West Side. And I would go, think of the music, because it was so gorgeous. But he kind of, part of not having the great success he deserved, I think he was afraid of success. And so it was one of those fear of success things. And then we would do these incredibly wonderful things together. And we were writing two shows at the same time also. We wrote a show called Grossingers, and which I was brought in on. He had been writing that for years with other collaborators, including Ronnie Graham, the famous comedy writer. And Ronnie threw his hands up and said, I can't do this anymore. And she said, oh, do you want it? I got the job, and it was a commission. And so we were writing this Jewish show in the Catskills, and then at the same time as the preacher, you know, I'm writing the River Jesus.
Oh my gosh.
And
my
about gosh. Borscht and Knishes at the same time. So it made him a little crazy. I was fine. I was used to doing two things at once. And at one point he said, we're not doing this show two things at once. I said, fine, slow down.
Would you guys write together?
The big question. What's always the big question? Which comes
always.
First, the words or the music? As Sammy Kahn always said, the contract. I usually write lyrics first, but it goes back and forth sometimes. I enjoy getting. I would get melodies from him sometimes, but mostly I would write a complete lyric. I would go over there and do it in rhythm for him in his tape recorder. Mm-hmm. And by the time I rode my bike home, he sometimes would have full things. He was really adept and fast and brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant music. And sounded like no one else. That's something that's hard to come by. People who have their own sound. You listen to Harvey Schmidt and he has his own sound.
Ooh, yeah.
The fantastic sounds like nobody else. And Klabe was like that too. And I think some of it is regional. It's the fact that it's the regionalism. I mean, he could write the Jewish music easily, but that wasn't him. The Night of the Hunter and the Grass Harp and just the way he talked, you know. Just, and then he played the piano brilliantly and he sang brilliantly. He could sing, but when I sang pretty well, and we would sing together. But he had a great voice. In fact, he told me Julie Stein was his sponsor to get into ASCAP when you had to have sponsors. And Julie said, I'd put you in any chorus of mine. Because he just had this big, wonderful voice.
Wow.
And I have demos of him singing stuff from Grasshopper, including our show stuff. But he would write. We were writing the score for Prodigious Voices, and Ron Raines was it.
Oh.
And we would go into the studio and do demos with Ron, and Ron would go, oh, my God, it goes so high, Klabe. And Klabe would go, it's thrilling. yelling. And it's true, you know, because he has that Barry Tenor thing going way up.
Anything.
And so we were lucky enough to make that CD.
You did. There was a cast recording.
It's a great CD.
I mean, a concept recording.
Yeah. This was all because of Bruce Kimmel. He loved the show from the first demos we gave him. Gave him like three songs, and he said, "I'll do it."
So he was like the producer of
the
recording.
He produced it. It was with Varese Sarabande. Yes. Then he was with that company, and he said, "I've always wanted." He was doing things like Lost in Boston.
Yep.
And he said, "I've always wanted to do a concept CD before it was ever a show." And we handed it to him.
You had Dorothy Loudon?
Oh, my God, yes. Dorothy, who was a great pal after that. And we had the greatest orchestrations by, you'll think of it in a second, because we had 26 pieces playing on that CD.
Yeah. Damn, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. And Todd Ellison conducted it, and then he became my collaborator later on.
That's right.
And Dorothy Loudon and Marshall Lewis and Sally Mays. Yeah, it's an incredible cast.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. We asked Barbara Cook first to do Dorothy Loudon's role because she had been in The Grass Harp. And she said, she called up Clay and said, "It's not for me." He never spoke to her again. And
ooh.
So I said, "Let's call Dorothy." And I did. I knew Dorothy from Drama League shows. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So I called her up, and she said, "Oh, yes. Oh, yes." And she was a blast.
It's fun to hear her. It's really fun to hear her.
She's great.
If a theater company wanted to do The Night of the Hunter, are the rights available?
They are. They are with me and my agent, absolutely.
So just contact you or the agent. And
we're looking for that new production of Night of the Hunter. We did it in San Francisco, premiered there. We did it in the New York Music Theater Festival, which was the best. And Beth Fowler played Dorothy Loudon's role, and she was fantastic, and Dee Hody was in it. It was a wonderful production. We did it then in Texas with the full 26-piece orchestra at Lyric Stage, where I've done lots of my shows. And it was great, but the New York one, with even with the only five pieces rather than 26, it was glorious. It was so I want to do the show again. In fact, I have it out to a famous director right now who I think would be fabulous for it.
Fabulous.
Who is Tony nominated today.
Hey, love that.
So now you can guess who it is.
But. I like that. You know what's interesting is that there is no set path on how to bring an original musical to the masses.
No.
There is no, like, follow these steps, boys and girls, and you will have your show on
stage.
Boy,
wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't it be nice?
Yeah. Yes.
You know? And I'm sure every single one of your shows has had a different gestation or a different process.
Absolutely.
You know?
And it's changed drastically since I first got shows on. It is much harder now. Now it really is about bring the money.
It's all about the money.
All about the money. It's always been sort of all about the money, but when I got Dodsworth on in 95, starring Hal Linden at Casa Mañana and Dee Hody, it was because the director, Bruce Lumpkin, just brought it to them and said, "Hey, why don't we do this show?" And they said, "Well, yeah, it's good, but nobody knows the title. Nobody knows the authors." And I think I was the one who said, "Get a star."
Mm-hmm.
And they got Hal Linden. And he, guess what? It sold tickets.
Yeah.
And people came and they saw the show and it moved on from there. So, you know, Dee was not a star then, but Hal was a TV star. And we did the same thing with Grossingers in the same theater. We had Ruta Lee, who is a star in Fort Worth, Texas. Let me tell you, you put Ruta Lee on a marquee in Fort Worth and they come for weeks.
Smart.
But we also had Gavin McLeod,
yes,
who the great Captain Steubing. Yeah. And that was a great experience. That was the non-Jewish Grossingers.
I was going to ask what the sort of story of Grossingers is.
Well, it's about Jenny Grossinger, the woman who created the hotel and the Catskill Mountains and the whole how the Jews came to the Catskills. And it's a very Jewish show. Mm. And when we did it in Fort Worth, they said, "Oh, nobody's going to get it here. No one knows what a blintz is." And they were wrong because all of a sudden the Jews came out of the woodwork. They all had accents, but they came out of the woodwork. And we also had a fabulous lobby display with all the photos of Jenny Grossinger and every star that played there.
Smart.
And ran "This Is Your Life, Jenny Grossinger" on a loop, which was from the 50s, and on a TV screen. So it worked out really great. But we did take out every reference. There wasn't an oi in sight.
Oh, funny.
It was smart. Very funny, yes. And then we put it back. We put it all back, and it became a show called Saturday Night at Grossingers, which is the same show with only six people. And that ran in L.A. and Florida. Mm-hmm. So that,
where in L.A. was it?
Betty Garrett's Theater in the Valley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which it ran for 4 months, which is a lot for L.A.
Oh, that's
they don't go to the
LA.
Theater there.
Not like that.
But everyone came out to see it because Grossingers, to a certain generation who is dying out now, you know, represented this great place where they all went for the summers and saw every star.
It's kind of like Friends, young people, when you watch the movie Dirty Dancing.
Yes.
It's like that. It's like, it was like families
well,
would go
is it like
hang
that.
Out there and part and dance and have
yes.
fun and put on shows.
And it was all about food and big stars and dancing and going there to find husbands and the pool. And they were open all year round. They had skiing. They had everything. Yeah. It was Las Vegas before Las Vegas.
Right.
And Dirty Dancing, you know, was supposed to take place at Grossingers, and it sort of does, but they weren't allowed to use the name Grossingers because we owned it.
Wow.
The ladies who bought the rights to Grossingers, we still had the – I once got a call from someone, said, well, can I use Grossingers in a movie? I said, how much?
Funny.
They weren't going to pay enough. So it didn't happen, no. So we still have the – we still
have
the
Kellerman.
Yes, Kellerman.
Yes, Kellerman.
Yes.
Hey,
supposed
I know,
to be
I've watched
Grossingers.
Dirty Dancing enough.
Yes.
That, but it's so close.
Grossingers
I mean,
is so famous,
yeah.
And it was the Cadillac of all those hotels. It was the Mecca and the top. And the woman, Jenny Grossinger, was an interesting character. And I got to know her daughter, and it's very interesting because she was a female entrepreneur in the early part of the 20th century and ran the place. So
that definitely lends itself to
it. It was a great
musical,
yeah. We had a good time.
And the song for Dorothy Loudon that I'm so curious if she ever recorded, Am I Too Broad for Broadway?
Right. That came because of that show, Comedy Tonight. So there we are. They're in previews on Broadway. And by this point, it's not three acts, but four, because Dorothy's understudy, when they were out of town, went on for her once. And her name was Joy Behar. And Joy Behar went on and did her comedy act, not Dorothy's comedy act, and couldn't sing, but she did her thing. And she was such a hit. And no one knew who she was that they put her in the Broadway show. And the others were Mort Saul and that guy who juggles and does comedy. And Dorothy's actually had a puppet, a Dorothy Loudon puppet. It was very funny. But it wasn't good. This was not a good show. It was at the Lunfontein. So they said, Dorothy, we should get an opening number for her. And so Jeff Saver and I wrote this song, Am I Too Broad for Broadway? Which actually came from a monologue that someone else had written. And I loved writing it. It was a blast. And we, all right, so the story goes, we go to Alexander Cohen's office, which was also his apartment, and we sing it for him, and he loves it. And it was like a movie. And he calls his wife in and says, come on in, you have to hear this song. And this is Hildy Parks, who wrote all the Tony Awards with him. And she says, oh, I love it. Call in the whole staff. They all listen. We're all singing the song. And there's Peter Howard, who's playing the show. And so they love it. And I said, this is it. This is my dream come true. I'm going to have a song on Broadway. We go to John Kander's house and play it for Dorothy a day later, and I'm singing it and I'm doing my best Dorothy Loudon, and they applaud and they all look at her, and she goes, I'm not singing that. And I went, oh. She said, we're in previews. I'm not learning anything new. That's too hard.
Wow.
And that was the end of that, and our dream went kablooey. And we went into the recording studio and recorded it with Mary Testa, who's brilliant on our demo. And it's just basically was so Dorothy, it was all about how she was too broad for Broadway, and she couldn't get into any shows. Like, she couldn't be in Sunset Boulevard because she was scared of heights, and the room kept going up and down. And they she did get cast in Beauty and the Beast as the bidet. So it was that kind of shtick. God. It was very funny
very
song,
funny.
And I'm very proud of that song. But she never sang.
Wow. Yeah.
And there is a recording of it. It's
Mary Testa recorded it. And so that's our demo.
Fitting.
One of these, oh, she was brilliant. Just brilliant. And if I were to do the song again, every year there's new shows. And these were old shows, Sunset Boulevard. And,
update.
Even she hadn't even done Showboat yet, because Showboat had just happened.
Okay.
And we had something about her shimmying on the cotton blossom and singing it. That kind of stuff. It was very funny stuff.
Wild.
I like writing that. That's special material.
Yes.
And that's fun to do. And she was going to do Gross Singers at one point. We were going to do this concert in L.A., which we wound up doing, with the Los Angeles Jewish Symphony Orchestra. You didn't know there was such a thing, did you? The Los Angeles Jewish Symphony Orchestra. And we had fabulous symphony orchestrations made for the show, and Dorothy was going to play the lead. And we were going to record it. And that was all exciting. Other great people were going to be in. And she rehearsed and got sick. And then she didn't do it. She wound up not doing it. But we decided we were going to keep everything in the same key that she sang in, which meant the basement at that time. And the poor woman who was going to do it in the concert would sing in those keys. We would record the orchestra and then go back and put her into it.
Wow.
The orchestra wasn't good enough, so it never really happened. That was another Bruce Kimmel thing that we were going to do, but we did the concert, and so some of it sounds okay. It was I hope the woman's not listening, but I remember she had her baton, and she got up and she raised her baton, and it flew out of her hands and hits one of the players, and the composer claims went, "Well, we're dead." Yep.
Sarah Stiles was
genius. Sarah Stiles was genius, as was Bruce Warren, who played opposite her. They had a scene in the show, which is a translation scene, which if you look on the script, it maybe takes a half a page. It was 5 minutes of hilarity, because every night they would improvise. It was translating, but physically. And it's what really went on there, the trying to get anybody to understand anything. It was hilarious. And she was just genius. She auditioned for us when we were going to do it in Texas first. And interestingly enough, we didn't pick her. And then I was like, what, are we crazy? And that wonderful, wonderful, funny voice. And she was sexy as hell.
Yeah.
And yeah, I had a blast. I had so much fun doing that show there. And we did. We produced it ourselves, did this concert version. Anita Gillette plays our mother. Incredible. Elizabeth Teeter, who is now one of the main witches in The Crucible, and was young Queen Elizabeth last year in the audience. So, Elizabeth Teeter plays Merman's apprentice, Muriel Plackenstein. And she came in and auditioned for us. She's brilliant. Just brilliant. You know who her father is?
Yes, I do.
Lara Teeter, who starred in On Your Toes in 1983. Tony nominee.
And now he runs a musical theater program, right?
Yeah, in St. Louis.
St. Louis,
and he has this wonderful family, and I think Elizabeth's the oldest daughter. There are other daughters. We keep hoping, because the girl's 12 years old, and Elizabeth's now 14-ish. We go, well, got any younger sisters? Because she's so talented and so good. Because procrastination is the name of the game.
Now, one of the things Kevin said, I'll hold him for 1 second. So one of the things Kevin was saying before, which is that people on there have very strong opinions. So we're going to ask you a series of questions, musical theater questions. You can either say your opinion, or you can say I decline to comment.
Okay.
But as he is Stephen Cole, and that's the highest level you can go in musical theater fandom.
It is true. That is the apex, the acme of fandom.
We were
fandom.
Talking about, you know, the big musical theater questions, and here we go. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. Best Sweeney Todd, Len Cariou, or George Hearn?
I saw both, definitely. And I don't remember Len as well, because George did the video. So I love George.
Yep.
And I saw George do it with Judy Kaye at Paper Mill. And that was the best. That was one of the best productions. Judy Kaye was stupendous. And one of my collaborators, Jeff Saver, was the conductor, and he told me that when George came to rehearsal, he said, teach me the notes. I never got to learn the notes on Broadway. He was a replacement.
Wow.
He said, I want to do it right. And boy, did he do it right.
Wow.
So that was a thrilling. So I like George.
George.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Greatest score from a forgotten musical is...
I know. What's forgotten? Is Follies forgotten? It's kind of one of the forgotten musicals. Follies was the greatest production, by the way, I ever saw in my life. I am so lucky to have been alive.
You saw the original,
And it still holds. But I would say, if we're on Greatest Sondheim, you know, that's harder, because Night Music is better in many ways, because Night Music's a better show.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Hugh Wheeler,
and the score is great. Music in the Air. How's that?
Good.
That's a great Oscar,
Way Back.
Yes. Because no one ever thinks Way Back. That's a
I adore Music in the Air. I'm on a real Music in the Air kick.
Like, love it. The best Mama Rose was...
Well.
Well, you know what? Isn't that sad that the only one I've never actually seen is Merman. I saw every single other one from Lansbury on. But because Merman had the fabulous tapes in her closet of her closing night, and I'm the one who got them out of that closet, I can say Merman because just listening to her performance is spectacular. When I saw Tyne Daly, I said that she heard the tapes because I thought Tyne Daly really gave a Merman performance.
Oh, interesting.
And because it's all about the comedy, and that's kind of gone by the wayside lately. Yes. The comedy.
Yeah.
If you're not funny and charming, why should we care? Then you're just a monster from word go. And Merman always said, and she said it to me, she said, she was a good mother. Rose was a good mother. I have to play her that way.
Yeah.
She said she was taking care of her girls. It was all for them, not for me. And that's true. Think about it. She only says it's for me at the very end. And so she's got 2 hours of it's all for them, not for me.
Yeah.
And that's how she played it. The positive, funny, charming. I'll do anything for those kids.
Good answer.
Yep.
Good answer. Ready for your next one?
Yes.
You're doing good so far.
Yes.
This is great.
The most overrated musical in the canon is...
Ever? Oh, my God.
The most overrated...
I choose to decline.
Great.
Nice. He's gonna know.
The most underappreciated musical in the canon is...
The Night of the Hunter.
Yes! That's it. Doing a few more. You're doing good.
Yes.
Who should star in a Mac and Mabel revival?
Nobody. I saw the original show. I saw it on the second night, and... it was as good as it was ever going to get. And it was a good show. But let me tell you, Bernadette Peters was incomparable. She knocked Robert Preston off the stage. She was that good. And if Bernadette Peters and Robert Preston and Gower Champion couldn't get it right, no one's going to get it right.
That's the answer.
Fair.
That's my feeling about that show.
Yeah.
Blank, this musical... deserved to win Best Musical, but didn't.
Follies.
Great. Is the revival of Chicago truly better than the original?
No! I saw the original. I not only saw the original, but I saw it with Liza Minnelli twice. Gwen Verdon, of course. Interestingly, Liza was fabulous. It was such an event to go see Liza and Cheetah, and she was stupendous. But when I went back and saw Gwen, I went, that's the show, because it's the older woman, and she was a brilliant actress. But some of the numbers were changed for Liza for the better. Me and My Baby became the baby number with all of them dressed as babies, and her as Eddie Cantor, and it was much better than what wound up in the show. So, yeah, I liked the revival very much. Don't get me wrong. And I'm glad it's so long run and everything. And when I saw it at Encores, I thought I died and went to heaven because I hadn't seen the show in so long. But the original had sets and costumes, and it was better.
The greatest leading man in musical theater history is?
Alfred Drake.
Nice.
Good answer.
Yeah.
We teach 3 forgotten musicals that you wish all musical theater students knew about.
The Cat and the Fiddle, Music in the Air. They are totally experimental shows, both of those. When you think about it, it's 1932 and 1933, and Kern is doing an experiment. Showboat has book songs and songs. There is not a song in each of those shows that is a book song. They are all have a reason for existing as songs in the show. Someone is singing all the time. Interesting experiment, and they both work on their own level. So those two are very... and then Any Sondheim.
Any Sondheim.
Yeah.
All of them.
3
all
more
them.
Questions,
yes.
And then we're going to get to go 3.
Yes, we're fine.
Kismet. Great score or just lucky with a newspaper strike?
Oh, no, great score. It's Borodin. Come on. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. And I love the lyrics. I think they're just delightful and funny. And
I love the score, too.
Yeah, I love Kismet.
Too.
How could you not like Kismet? I mean, we're talking major, major music here for singers.
Really?
Yeah.
Which is the more influential rock musical, Hair or Rent?
I think Rent. Yeah, I mean, Hair was not influential at all. Hair was just one thing that happened. It influenced a lot badly at the time. It influenced Clive Barnes to say, I don't think any musical is a musical without a rock score.
And it influenced him to give Follies a terrible review and Company a terrible review. He thought all shows should have rock scores. So that was a very bad influence. And most of those shows that poor Galt McDermott wrote after were disasters. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Via Galactica and these shows, they were disasters. Right. Whereas Rent has been a little more influential.
Great.
A little more.
Last question.
Okay.
Greatest overture to a musical. You cannot say Gypsy.
Well, Candide then. Or 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Oh, I love you for saying that.
Good choice. Yeah,
that's Bernstein. A gorgeous overture.
It is.
And it's not on the CD that they released of the recording, because they never released 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. They did White House Cantata and opera singers, blah. Oh, yeah. But they left off the opening number and the overture. And the overture should be take its place with Candide as a great...
Agreed.
Concert piece.
Brilliant.
So, yeah. And I saw 1600. Ha! I was there.
And I believe David Crane was a rehearsal pianist.
Yes, that was his first show. Yeah. That was his first show. And he was a Leonard Bernstein protege because of that. Yeah. So, yeah, that was his first show. It's a
full circle.
Full circle.
Join us next week when we interview Broadway and television icon Nancy Dessau.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.